Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. My name is Dave Marshall and today I'm going to be interviewing Thomas Clements of the University of Leicester all about an enigmatic fossil called the Tully Monster. No, you've not misheard. We've back-to-back episodes about the same fossil. Despite what the newspapers would lead you to believe with their headlines of mystery finally solved, in science, the door is never shut, the case is never closed, and we find ourselves, only a couple of weeks after our last interview, yet again revising our interpretations. But before we get into the details, we've got a little bit of PaleoCast admin to go through. Firstly, we've our crowdfunding campaign to create the Virtual Natural History Museum, a website that will grant the world better access to digital fossil collections by putting them all in a huge online computer game museum. We're working with teachers to ensure that content will be relevant for schools, and so really everyone can benefit. There are just a couple of days left of the campaign, and this thing is going to go right down to the wire. So please donate and bag yourself a t-shirt or some other great rewards. Secondly, it's podcast award season, and from the 15th to 30th of April, you can vote for us at podcastawards.com. So last year, we were a top 10 finalist in the education category, and this year, we're going to win it. Every day, you're allowed to vote, and every day, each one of us, yes, including you, is going to put down your favourite paleontological show in the education category. And then we'll win a trophy, there'll be cake, much rejoicing, and so on. But back to the episode in hand. This interview coincides with the release of Thomas's article in Nature, and so again, it's a paleontological news story hot off the press. We hope that this will be the definitive article on the paper, so please share it with everyone you think might be interested, and we can keep everyone at the cutting edge of paleontological research. So, I hope you enjoy this, another episode about the Tully Monster. So, hi Thomas, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hello.
Can you tell us when and where you decided to become a paleontologist?
Yeah, so I have a bit of an odd route into paleontology in that I never, although I collected fossils as a kid, I grew up near Lyme Regis, so I used to go fossil collecting with my parents a lot, but I never really grew up wanting to be a paleontologist. In fact, I didn't really know what I wanted to do when I left school. I actually got a job working in an operating theatre with the NHS because I thought I wanted to go into medicine like my mother. Mm-hmm. And one day I went to London and I went to the Natural History Museum. And if you've been to the Natural History Museum, you'll know that they have a long corridor full of marine reptiles. And at the end is a big wooden door, which is for staff only. And someone had left it open. And being slightly bold and naughty, I walked through said door and was looking around. And then some old chap came steaming around the corner and sort of went, "Oi, what are you doing here?" And I sort of said, you know, I just got lost and I was walking around, and he basically told me to leave quite politely. And I just said to him, you know, "Do you work here?" And he said, yes, he was holding a fossil. And I said, "How do you get to work with fossils?" And he said, "Well, I went to university and did paleontology and geology." And so that kind of inspired me. And I went off and did an undergrad and in geology, then did a master's. Now I'm doing my PhD. And weirdly enough, last year, said paleontologist came and was the honorary doctorate at Leicester, and I met him, and his name is Richard Forty. He's a really, really famous paleontologist, and when I met him, I was just a gibbering wreck. It was quite funny.
That's brilliant. How old were you?
I was about 19.
Oh, I thought you were going to say like 9.
No, I was about 19.
All right. And does he remember that? Or does he not know?
He said very politely that he had a vague recollection, but the look on his face tells me he probably didn't. But he signed my book, which was really nice.
I'd like the thought of him just wandering around the Natural History Museum, just holding a trilobite or something.
Do you know, I actually think he was holding a trilobite. He was obviously on his way to his office or something, but he wasn't best impressed that I was just hanging around in the back.
he's probably doing that right now, actually, as we record this. Just wandering the halls holding tons yes. of trilobites.
Stalking the wings of the Natural History Museum.
Making sure no one breaks in.
If he hears this, he's going to kill me.
well, he's been on. I actually recorded in those through that said door with Richard Thorty right. when we did, I think it was episode 19, I'm going to say, which was Trilobites.
I'll fact check that later.
A little known fact is that our logo, the Willisirops trifocatus, the little trilobite with a fork on its head, is named Richard Forky. So there's a little paleocast trivia for everyone.
You said that paleontologists don't have a sense of humour.
anyway, let's get back on track.
Sorry.
After that little excursion around the Natural History Museum. So you're doing a PhD, and that is on the taphonomy of Mazon Creek, which is something that we talked about last episode. So what questions are you looking to answer?
So my PhD is looking at this fossil bed. It's about 307 million years old. It's found in Illinois. And we're trying to look at the preservation and how these fossils are preserved, because not only does the Mazon Creek preserve loads of different types of organism, but also it preserves basically the soft, juicy bits like muscles and skin and internal organs and even eyes that you wouldn't expect to be preserved in the fossil record. And it's my job to kind of try and work out how that happens.
So how did you get into this? I mean, your inspiration was Richard Forty. So how did you end up working on the Mazon Creek, which has no trilobites, I don't think, does it?
It has a putative trilobite, question mark.
All right.
I'm sorry, Richard Forty, but I'm not really interested in trilobites too much. I actually got into paleo, and I was really interested in like dinosaur brains. I wanted to know how smart dinosaurs were. And I was also really interested in paleopathology, which is the study of illnesses and disease in the fossil record. And I went to Bristol to do paleontology as a master's degree. And while I was there, I did a module with Maria McNamara all about taphonomy. And it really captured my imagination. I had never thought, I understood and I appreciated how wonderful and amazing fossils are, but I never understood the actual processes that these organisms have to undergo to enter the fossil record, but also all of the processes which stop organisms from entering the fossil record. And that really blew my mind. And I did my master's project was a taphonomic experiment on cephalopods with Jakob Winther. And then from there, I applied for a PhD with Professor Gabbett, Sarah Gabbett, and Professor Mark Purnell at Leicester, who advertised for a project on the taphonomy of the Mazon Creek. So I've kind of gone through it in that route, really.
Okay. So this episode, we're going to be talking about the Tully Monster again. So the last episode we released, it was episode 62 with Victoria McCoy, also of Leicester University. And that was on the same fossil. So we recommend that you go and listen to that episode first. But for those people that can't be bothered and those that don't want to have to listen to another hour of me talking, can you just give us a quick recap on things? So can you describe to us the Mazon Creek paleo environment? What's going on there?
So the Mazon Creek paleo environment is quite an interesting story for a fossil bed, because normally what you find in fossil beds are that they're one particular, very specific environment, which has some sort of exceptional qualities to allow fossils to be preserved. But the Mazon Creek is actually kind of a bit of a mixture. We have fossils which show quite clearly that they're from sort of a terrestrial environment. We also have fossils that show that they're quite clearly from a freshwater environment. And then conversely from that, we have fossils which show that they're from some sort of marine environment. And it's been postulated that there's some sort of a river which flowing out into some sort of estuary or embayment, and that there is some sort of event occurring which is washing these fossils out and they're all being preserved together. And actually, part of my PhD is trying to constrain this, because although it's written in the literature and that's kind of the understanding, there isn't actually a super amount of evidence for that. And actually, the Mazon Creek is far more complicated than that. So that's part of my project, is trying to work out what the actual real paleo environment is.
So if I remember my undergrad when we were learning about Lagerstätte, these sites of special preservation, I think I remember that it's geographically distributed in Chicago now. Like one area, like say, to the north and south divide? That one area is more terrestrial and the other area is more marine. So does it have that spatial differentiation?
Yeah, very much so. So in the 1980s, a chap called Gordon Baird did some really great work where he looked at fossils that were collected all across the Maison area. So the reason why it's called the Maison Creek Lagerstätte is that the river that runs through that area is the Maison Creek or Maison River. And actually, the fossils are found in a shale called the Francis Creek Shale Member. And so he did some statistical work which showed that there was this clear divide. But actually, when you look at the statistics and when you look at other things, there are some slight, there are fossils which are skewing that, basically in the plant matter. And he actually also sort of said, well, actually, there's some gradational fauna in there as well. And he actually gave them a name, but it hasn't really been taken up in the literature. So we're looking at we went out there and we collected fossils from different sites to see if we can actually show whether it's either a gradational change or whether there is this clear divide. And that's something which my PhD is looking at the moment.
Any sneak previews on that? Is there?
I wouldn't want to scoop myself at this point too much, but I don't know if I agree so much with the sort of accepted model of the Maison Creek. I think there's something different going on.
Okay, so let's look at the fossils themselves. How are they preserved?
So the fossils in the Maison Creek are preserved in nodules. And these are nodules of a mineral called iron carbonate, or siderite is what geologists call it. And it's so the host rock, the sort of the rock that if you were walking down the river, you would see is this gray shale material. It's very fine grained. And it's although it's quite platy, it powders in your hand quite easily. It's very fissile. And the fossils, however, are preserved in this solid rock, which is a sort of muddy brown color. Some can be a little bit red, some can be a little bit yellow, but there's sort of muddy rocks. And they're not consistent sizes. Some of them are round, quite spherical. Some of them are very flat and platy. Some of them are really odd shaped. So local collectors call them nipple nodules. And that's because they look exactly like sort of human nipples, really. And they're just really bizarre. And some nodules are shaped like the fossil inside them. Some nodules don't have anything inside them. We call them dud nodules. And some nodules are, you can find bits of wood, fossilized wood, just sticking out of them. So there are a whole range of shapes. And it's not quite clear yet whether the organism decaying and turning into a fossil causes this nodule to form around it, or whether the fact that these nodules are just naturally forming and encapsulating any organic matter which just happens to be in the shale when it was forming. And this is a question that I'm trying to answer at the moment. It's very difficult because a lot of the nodules, the fossils are incomplete. They're missing parts. There are some nodules where there are fossils stuck on the outside. There are some nodules which have no fossils at all. It's a real mystery. And we're trying to look at modern siderite concretions and how they form and see if that will give us a clue as to whether the fossils influence the nodules or whether the nodules are just forming. And it's just a lucky accident that we have fossils inside there.
One of the fossils you actually get from Maison Creek is the Tully Monster. Can you give us a bit of the history of the discovery of this organism?
So Tully Monster, or Tully Monstrum gregarium, was discovered by a guy called Francis Tully in the 50s. And he was an amateur fossil collector. And he was collecting in a site called Pit 11. And Pit 11 was this huge strip mine, which they were looking for coal. And on top of the layer of coal that they were removing is where the Maison Creek fossils are found. And the coal company didn't really care for the fossils. They were just waste material. So they were often just dumped. And the company, which was called the Peabody Company, allowed fossil collectors to go out and look for fossils. And Francis Tully discovered lots of these weird animal and didn't have a clue what they were. So he took them to the Field Museum, to the invertebrate curator, who was a guy called Eugene Richardson. And he sort of said, look, I've discovered this creature. And the real problem was that when Eugene Richardson had looked at it, he couldn't work out what Tully Monstrum was either, but he gave it the name, Tully Monstrum Gagarium. So the name, Victoria sort of said it in the last episode, but it means Tully's monster, and the Gagarium comes from basically because it's so common. It's found, basically, it's found a lot in this Pit 11 site. And that's kind of where it stemmed from. There's been lots of studies on it since, and no one has sort of actually been able to sort of identify it definitely. And so we decided that we were going to have a look at it.
So what kind of groups have people interpreted the Tully Monster as belonging to?
So Tully Monster has been allied to a whole range of organismal groups, everything from nematodes to polychaetes, which are worms. There are also different types of worms, like spoon worms that it has been allied to, arthropods, mollusks, even to a group of extinct chordates called the conodonts. And they said that it might be a conodont because of the way of its tail orientation, but also because it has teeth.
And the McCoy paper that came out last month, was it? No, it wasn't that long ago.
It was about 2-3 weeks ago, yeah.
Yeah, what was their conclusion and what evidence did they draw upon?
So they concluded that it was a chordate and that it was probably related to the lampreys, or was some form of stem lamprey, I should say. And they suggested that they discovered things like gill pouches and myomeres, but also evidence of a notochord, which is this sort of non-bony backbone, if you will, if that makes sense. Like a nervous cord this animal has. And that's a key character which allies it with the chordates.
Okay, but something that you looked at instead was the eyes of the Tully Monster. And this is a paper that you've comes out today, same time as the podcast. Can you describe to us what they looked like?
So something that's really important about Tully Monster is it has this transverse bar structure. So if you imagine, I'm sure most of your listeners will have actually seen a picture of a Tully Monster now and will be quite aware of the transverse bar. But if you imagine the body as kind of torpedo shaped, towards the head end, they had this sort of elongate bar, which stretched over, laterally over the animal's body. And it's quite weird looking. And I think really importantly, I have to say at this point, is that no one has ever shown that they're actually eyes. So people have suggested that they were eyes. In fact, I think it was the second paper or the third paper on Tully Monstrum sort of suggested that these things might be eyes. But they've actually been suggested to be everything from sensory organs to hydrodynamic stabilizers to feelers, like CT or feelers. But there's even been one suggestion that they're some sort of paired copulatory organ, which... I think you'll agree, would probably be quite a risque adaptation to have your gonads just hanging off you on stalks like that. So no one has actually conclusively shown that they're eyes. And actually, our work on Tully Monstrum kind of stems from a different route. We didn't actually set out to look at Tully Monster and to answer the question. We were looking at other Maison Creek animals. We were looking at the vertebrates, the fish and the amphibians, but also primitive chordates like hagfish and lampreys. So I was working with Professor Sarah Gabbett and Professor Mark Pennell at University of Leicester, and we were really interested in looking at the taphonomy of these animals. And we noticed that all of these animals had these dark stains at the front region of their head. And these stains are often paired. And we're not the first people to notice this. So there was a really good paper by authors Salen and Coates in 2014 on a type of shark from the Maison Creek called Bandringia. And they too noticed that this shark had these two dark carbonaceous stains and also had clay minerals that were preserving what they thought was the lens of the eye. And so we were looking at these other Maison Creek vertebrates, and we noticed that one day I was just going through some fossils, and we actually have a Tully Monster at Leicester, and I suddenly noticed that Tully Monster had these dark stains as well. So I thought, we better stick this under the scanning electron microscope, and lo and behold, we discovered that it has the same characters that the other Maison Creek vertebrates have in their eyes. And that's kind of the big clue we needed, that sort of once and for all says these are definitely eyes and not any other structure.
Why is the fact that they're black tell you that they're eyes?
So that's a really good question. So actually, the colour is a kind of a giveaway, because in the Maison Creek, the eyes of these organisms, or I should say, going back a step in the argument, that all of the, where we would imagine the eyes to be is always stained black. So we can't say, oh, because these are black, they're eyes. What we say is that actually where we expect eyes to be is stained black. And when we looked under the scanning electron microscope, we discovered something really exciting, that in all of these animals, the black organic carbon stain is actually the preserved remains of pigments. And these pigments are a real key indicator that these are eyes, because eyes in vertebrates are heavily pigmented. And those pigments are, there are certain structures that we can see which give clear indications that these are eyes. And I'm sure we can talk about that more in more detail. But that was kind of the big giveaway, that these were eyes in the vertebrates. And then when we looked at the Tully monster, we saw exactly the same characters. And so that was the sort of smoking gun, if you will, that these were indeed eyeballs.
Right. So again, if you want to know more about this kind of thing, we've already got an episode, episode 52 with, what's she called? She's on
Caitlin
the show.
Caitlin Cleary.
That's the one. Thank you very much. Hi, Kate. it's been a while since I've heard from you. You should do an episode.
We're so dead.
So how many people have we annoyed in this? Richard 40, Caitlin.
So it's not over yet.
Go back and give that episode a listen if you want to hear more about how this pigment is identified in the fossil record. But again, as a quick recap, can you tell us how we're able to identify this pigment, what it looks like and where it is?
So melanin is a pigment that is found in nearly all animals. It's found throughout the animal kingdom. And in humans, it does things like give us the color of our hair, also the color of our skin. And melanin is found within melanosomes, which are an organelle inside cells, which synthesize and store that pigment. An important thing about melanosomes is that they come in different morphologies. So we can tell what type of melanosome they are in living animals by the shape. So there are two key shapes to sort of look out for, which I think we'll have a picture of our findings. But you can see that there are these long, thin, rod-shaped or inverted commas sausage-shaped ones, which are eumelanin, and they give brown and black pigment colours. And then these round, spherical or meatball-shaped ones, which are pheomelanins, and they give red colours. And that was really important for our findings, because they gave a key clue as to the structures of pigment that we see in the eyes of Tully monstrum.
Okay, first I'd just like to get onto what's the purpose of having melanin in our eyes. Why do we need our eyes to be pigmented?
So in vertebrate eyes, there are three main tissues which contain melanin: the iris, the choroid, and the retinal pigmented epithelium. And in the retinal pigmented epithelium, the melanosomes do a couple of really key jobs, actually. Firstly, they protect your receptor cells from UV light. So if you accidentally look into the sun and you get that little white spot where you've been temporarily blinded, the melanosomes around the receptor cells actually are absorbing the UV and protecting them so that they're not damaged too much. Another really important property that melanosomes have is that they're actually antibacterial. So they act to stop infections of the receptor cells and stop your retina from getting infected. But the most important job that it does, that melanosomes do, is that it absorbs stray light. So normally what happens is that light bounces off an object, enters your eye, the receptor cells pick up that light and send a signal to your brain, which then interprets it as an image. If you were to strip out your pigment from the back of your eye, the light would actually bounce around inside your eyeball, and you wouldn't be able to form a clear visual image. You just have a white image. So that is the most important job that pigments do in the eye.
We're looking, therefore, at an organelle, something with inside a cell. But how did you even expect to see that in a fossil? We don't have the cells preserved. How do we expect to find the contents of the cell preserved?
So I think that's a really good question. And I think the simple answer is that there have been lots of experiments to show that melanin is incredibly recalcitrant. And that term basically means that it resists decay. So while everything else is decaying around it, the melanosomes are really intact. And I think a big part of that, and I don't actually have any evidence for this, I think this is quite anecdotal, but I think a big part of that is that, as I discussed earlier, melanin is antibacterial, so it actually stops bacteria from decaying it. And I think that's probably a reason why it persists for so long in the fossil record.
One of the things that keeps on getting flagged up with melanin as well, the little sausagey shaped ones, the tiny, like, how was it, 20, 50 of them in the width of a human hair?
Yeah, I think between 50 or 80, something like that. Yeah.
How can you distinguish that from bacteria? We're looking at dead organisms here. They would be teeming with bacteria absolutely everywhere. How can you be sure that these things are melanosomes and not just bacteria?
So I think just in the question, you kind of answered it really, because if these were bacteria, you would expect to find them everywhere, right? So we've done decay experiments and we know that during decay, bacteria, basically, the populations just absolutely explode. And in fact, a bit paradoxically, in order to get exceptional preservation, you actually need decay to happen. So we would expect to see these tiny structures absolutely everywhere, and we don't. We actually see them only in the parts of the animal where we would expect to see pigment. And I think that's a really key clue. So there's actually a really big debate in paleontology at the moment about whether these tiny granules are bacteria or whether they're these pigment, whether they're melanosomes. And I think the argument against them being melanosomes, the argument for being bacteria, is quite weak because, like you say, if they're bacteria, they'd be everywhere. The proponents of them being bacteria say that they're the same shape and size as melanosomes, but actually we see a much bigger variation in the size of bacteria. So if these were bacteria, then we would expect to see a lot bigger ones and a lot smaller ones, and we don't see that. These are very consistent. We also see them arranged in structures, and they're aligned in certain ways that we know that living animals have those same structures. We don't know. There is some evidence that bacteria do align, but in things like feathers, for instance, with melanosomes, you find that they orientate themselves specifically into what part of the feather they're in. And you see that in the fossils too. So I think the evidence is overwhelming at the moment that these are indeed melanosomes. And there is one key piece of evidence, other than all of the small individual things that you're looking for and in their morphology, and that is that the melanosomes have a key chemical signature. And that was proved in a really great paper by Kaleri et al. In 2015, where they showed that modern melanosomes of the different types have key chemical signatures, and that fossil melanosomes also have key signatures which show that they are indeed melanosomes. And we actually utilized their techniques to prove that these structures in Tullymontium are definitely melanosomes.
Right, so we found melanin, but if it's present in eyes anyway, we expect to find it there, then what's the significance?
Well, in Tullymonstrum, when we were looking at eyes, or we were looking at these bar organs, we stuck them under scanning electron microscope and found melanosomes. And then we tested and they contained melanin. And we were really excited. We thought, well, that's going to tell us what type of animal Tullymonstrum is. And we went away and we looked at the type of pigments in basically all the different animal types that are around at the moment, what science knows about those pigments. And actually, what we found was that nearly all animal groups can synthesize melanin. So we were really disappointed. We thought, oh, well, we've got a bit of a dud result here. We've just found a really old pigment. But actually, we were looking at the scanning electron microscope, looking at these images, and what we discovered was that the two types of melanosome that I talked about earlier, the sausage-shaped and the round-shaped ones, we actually found both types of melanosomes in Tullymonstrum's eyes. And that was really exciting for us, because it's known that only vertebrates can produce these two types of melanosomes. Invertebrates can only produce one type of melanosome. And Furthermore, when we looked at the structures of these melanosomes, we noticed that they were very distinctly layered. So you have layerings of sausage ones and layerings of meatball ones, and they are very rarely mixed, and they're quite distinctly layered. And that was even more exciting because that showed us that they actually had this structure of a retinal pigmented epithelium at the back of their eye. And so these two findings were the sort of key giveaway, but it was the mixing of the two different types of melanosomes, or I shouldn't say mixing, just the two morphology of melanosomes, which was the key clue, which suggested that this animal was a vertebrate.
So it really corroborates the conclusions of the McCoy paper then?
So the McCoy paper suggests that Tully Monstrum is some form of lamprey. And our research suggests that Tully Monstrum is definitely some form of vertebrate. We think it's probably some form of non-osteichthyan total group vertebrate, which means it's a non-bony fish. But because we think Tully Monstrum has a jaw, and we think that Tully Monstrum's teeth are probably biomineralized, then we think it's probably some form of gnathostome. So that's like some sort of jawed fish. And I think our findings basically suggest that Tully Monstrum is a form of weird fish.
So the gnathostomes are a more advanced group of fishes than the lampreys and hagfish.
Yeah, I think that Tully Monstrum probably sits a little bit higher in the tree. But, you know, this is part of science and it's part of the debate. We focus solely on the eyes of Tully Monstrum, and most of the work that we've done on the jaw actually didn't go into our paper. And so that's stuff that we're going to work on in the future in our taphonomy papers. And the McCoy paper shows quite good evidence, I think, that they didn't find any evidence for biomineralization in the teeth. So at the moment, there's obviously going to be some debate about where Tully Monstrum sits, but I think we can both agree that it's some form of chordate.
So if you'd have read the newspapers over the past couple of weeks, or even looked online, you'd have seen all of these sensational headlines after the McCoy paper saying, like, mystery finally solved, it's definitely this. But, I mean, a couple of weeks later and the story's already evolving. So do you think that we're now there? Is it going to keep on going? Are we going to keep on revising our interpretation of this organism?
I think that's a really great question. And invariably the answer is yes, it has to continue. Because organisms that are enigmatic are always going to capture the imagination of people. And so people are always interested. And the problem with paleontology, especially science like this, is that we observe characters and we do our best to categorize them. And then from there, we make our inferences. But other paleontologists might not agree with our inferences at all. And in fact, in our work, one thing that I would say about the science of our work is that it was really hard work to find data on the pigments in the eyes of all organismal groups. So, there, for instance, there's hardly any data on the pigments of nematodes and some mollusks. I don't know if you know, but jellyfish have eyes, and true jellyfish, the Scyphozoans, I can't say it properly, but you'll have to, if there's jellyfish workers out there, I apologize profusely. But their pigment isn't really particularly well known. And also pigments of echinoderms aren't really greatly known. And so I think, for instance, in our work, if some, normally biologists, they look at eyes and they see that it has screening pigment, whatever organism they're looking at, and they just tick the box, it has screening pigments. They don't necessarily care so much about what those pigments actually are. It's not particularly informative. But now that paleontologists are starting to look at these pigments, and they're really informative, and they tell us a lot about these animals because the majority of the eye is rotted away, then maybe now biologists will start looking at these screening pigments. And in a week, 3 weeks, 8 weeks, a month's time, a year's time, some biologists might turn around and say, well, actually, you're wrong because echinoderms have these two types of pigments. And that's the sort of question that we as paleontologists need answering. So I think, yes, there's always going to be evolution, and I hope there will be. I think Tully Monstrum deserves more work done on it, to be honest.
And looking at the Mason Creek in general, You've already said that a lot of the fossils there, a lot of the vertebrate fossils there, have these paired dark splodges, the eyes. Have you compared any of the different groups to each other? We've got hagfishes in there, we've got sharks. Have you compared the Tully Monstrum to those? Because that would really tell you a lot, I think.
Yeah, so we compared Tully Monster to sharks, the band Ringier that we talked about earlier, we've compared it to. We've also compared it to fish and to the fossil lampreys. And we see consistently these melanosome structures and morphologies within those animals. And so if that is the smoking gun that sort of tells us what organism Tully Monster is. And I think it's in, we have some really nice figures in our paper, in the supplementary data, which we can put up, and you can compare for yourself the melanosome morphologies. We even show them in 3D so you can see the different layers.
And the melanosomes that you found in the Tully Monster are actually the oldest ones that have ever been identified.
Yeah, so it's a bit tricky because Professor Gabbert was looking at these hagfish and lampreys before I even started my PhD. And she presented that work at a conference. But it's still her work's still in press at the moment. So we've kind of snuck in and claimed that for ourselves. But obviously, I can't take the full credit for that. I have to give it to Sarah. Otherwise, I might have annoyed another person in this podcast.
We'll get round to everyone in the paleontological field. Do you think that we're going to find even older melanosomes? Should we be looking in fossils in like the Silurian and Devonian, even Ordovician Cambrian, for these fossil pigments?
Yep, absolutely. I think 100%. We should... I don't know if anyone has looked in the Cambrian fossils. I'm almost certain that they have. I know people have been looking at certain eyes. Whether they find them or not, because of the way that the Cambrian, especially like Burgess fossils, Burgess shale fossils are preserved, I'm not sure that melanosomes will necessarily preserve there. But yes, almost certainly we should start looking at older Lagerstätten and see if melanosomes are preserved. It's really informative about these animals. So I think it's a key thing that people should start looking out for.
So do you think we're into a golden age of melanosome research?
I think the melanosome age of paleontology is kind of already a thing. I mean, since 2008, melanosomes have revolutionized how we've looked at paleontology, being able to discover ancient animals' color, their ecology. They've been used to infer thermoregulation in marine reptiles, and now they've been used to infer structures in 307 million-year-old eyes of bizarre creatures that are surreal and weird. And so I think, you know, I think the golden age of melanosomes is already kind of here. I think we're living in it. We're living in the golden age of melanosomes.
And with that, thank you very much for joining us, Thomas.
Thank you for having me.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall, with Joe Keating, Laura Soule, Liz Martin-Silverstone and Caitlin Coleri. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on contributions from you, the listeners. If you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. We'd also like to thank the Ocean Collective for use of their music. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed @PaleoCast and like us at facebook.com/PaleoCast to get all the latest news.